or the narrow, stony road, the foothills rising high and wild all around them, and the jagged, snow-capped peaks on the distant horizon, all the hope went out of him in a rush.
"This is the High Road,"
he gasped, looking at Lady Stark with accusation.
"The Eastern Road. You said we were riding for Winterfell."
Catelyn Stark favoured him with the faintest of smiles.
"Often and loudly," she agreed.
"No doubt your friends will ride that way when they come after us. I wish them good speed." Even now, long days after, the memory filled him with a bitter rage. All his life, Tyrion had prided himself on his cunning, the only gifts the guards had seen fit to give him, and yet this seven-times-damned she-wolf, Catelyn Stark, had outwitted him at every turn. The knowledge was more galling than the bare fact of his abduction. They stopped only as long as it took to feed and water the horses, and then they were off again. This time, Tyrion was spared the hood. After the second night, they no longer bound his hands, and once they had gained the heights, they scarcely bothered to guard him at all. It seemed they did not fear his escape, and why should they? Up here, the land was harsh and wild, and the high road little more than a stony track. If he did run, how far could he hope to go, alone and without provisions? The Shadow Cats would make a morsel of him, and the clans that dwelt in the mountain fastnesses were brigands and murderers, who bowed to no law but the sword. Yet still the Stark woman drove them forward relentlessly. He knew where they were bound. He had known it since the moment they pulled off his hood. These mountains were the domain of House Aaron, and the late Hand's widow was a Tully, Catelyn Stark's sister and no friend to the Lannisters. Tyrion had known the Lady Lysa slightly during her years at King's Landing, and did not look forward to renewing the acquaintance. His captors were clustered around a stream a short ways down the high road. The horses had drunk their fill of the icy cold water and were grazing on clumps of brown grass that grew from clefts in the rock. Jick and Morrick huddled close, sullen and miserable. Mohor stood over them, leaning on his spear and wearing a round iron cap that made him look as if he had a bowl on his head. Nearby, Marillion, the singer, sat oiling his wood harp, complaining of what the damp was doing to his strings.
"We must have some rest, my lady,"
the hedge knight, Sir Willis Woad, was saying to Catelyn Stark as Tyrion approached. He was Lady Wentzman, stiff-necked and stolid, and the first to rise to aid Catelyn Stark back at the inn.
"Sir Willis speaks true, my lady," Sir Roderick said. "This is the third horse we have lost.
We will lose more than horses if we're overtaken by the Lannisters," she reminded them. Her face was windburnt and gaunt, but it lost none of its determination.
"Small chance of that here," Tyrion put in.
"The lady did not ask your views, dwarf," snapped Curlicat, a great fat oath, with short-cropped hair and a pig's face.
He was one of the Brackens, a man-at-arms in the service of Lord Jonas. Tyrion had made a special effort to learn all their names so that he might thank them later for their tender treatment of him. A Lannister always pays his debts. Curlicat would learn that some day, as would his friends, Larys and Mohar, and the good Sir Willis, and the sellswords Bronn and Chiggan. He planned an especially sharp lesson for Marillion, him of the wood harp and the sweet tenor voice, who was struggling so manfully to rhyme imp with gimp and limp, so he could make a song of this outrage. "Let him speak," Lady Stark commanded. Tyrion Lannister seated himself on a rock.
"By now our pursuit is likely racing across the neck, chasing your lie up the King's Road, assuming there is a pursuit, which is by no means certain. Oh, no doubt the word has reached my father, but my father does not love me overmuch, and I am not at all sure that he will bother to bestir himself."
It was only half a lie. Lord Tywin Lannister cared not a fig for his deformed son, but he tolerated no slights on the honour of his house.
This is a cruel landlady, Stark. You'll find no succour until you reach the Vale. And each mount you lose burdens the others all the more. Worse, you risk losing me. I'm small and not strong, and if I die, then what's the point?
That was no lie at all. Tyrion did not know how much longer he could endure this pace. It might be said that your death is the point, Lannister, Catelyn Stark replied.
I think not, Tyrion said. If you wanted me dead, you had only to say the word, and one of these staunch friends of yours would gladly have given me a red smile.
He looked at Curlicuet, but the man was too dim to taste the mockery. The Starks do not murder men in their beds.
Nor do I, he said. I tell you again, I had no part in the attempt to kill your son.
The assassin was armed with your dagger. Tyrion felt the heat rise in him.
It was not my dagger, he insisted. How many times must I swear to that? Lady Stark, whatever you may believe of me, I am not a stupid man. Only a fool would arm a common footpad with his own blade.
Just for a moment, he thought he saw a flicker of doubt in her eyes. But what she said was, why would Ptah lie to me?
Why does a bear shit in the woods? He demanded. Because it is his nature. Lying comes as easily as breathing to a man like Littlefinger.
You ought to know that, eh? You of all people.
She took a step toward him, her face tight. And what does that mean, Lannister?
Tyrion cocked his head. Why, every man at court has heard him tell how he took your maidenhead, my lady.
That is a lie, Catelyn Stark said.
A wicked little imp,
Marillion said, shocked. Curlicuet drew his dirk, a vicious piece of black iron.
At your word, my lady, I'll touch his lying tongue at your feet.
His pig eyes were wet with excitement at the prospect. Catelyn Stark stared at Tyrion with a coldness on her face such as he had never seen. Ptah Baelish loved me once. He was only a boy. His passion was a tragedy for all of us, but it was real and pure, and nothing to be made mock of. He wanted my hand. That is the truth of the matter.
You are truly an evil man, Lannister. And you are truly a fool, Lady Stark. Littlefinger has never loved anyone but Littlefinger, and I promise you that it is not your hand that he boasts of. It's those ripe breasts of yours, and that sweet mouth, and the heat between your legs.
Curlicuet grabbed a handful of hair and yanked his head back in a hard jerk, baring his throat. Tyrion felt the cold kiss of steel beneath his chin.
Shall I bleed him, my lady?
Kill me, and the truth dies with me, Tyrion gasped.
Let him talk, Catelyn Stark commanded. Curlicuet let go of Tyrion's hair, reluctantly. Tyrion took a deep breath.
How did Littlefinger tell you I came by this dagger of his? Answer me that.
You won it from him in a wager during the tourney on Prince Joffrey's name day.
When my brother Jaime was on horse by the Knight of Flowers. That was his story, no?
It was, she admitted. A line creased her brow.
Riders!
The shriek came from the wind-carved ridge above them. Sir Roderick had sent Larry scrambling up the rock face to watch the road while they took their rest. For a long second, no one moved. Catelyn Stark was the first to react. Sir Roderick, Sir Willis, to horse, she shouted. Get the other mounts behind us. Mohor, guard the prisoners.
Armas!
Tyrion sprang to his feet and seized her by the arm.
You will need every sword.
She knew he was right. Tyrion could see it. The mountain clans cared nothing for the enmities of the great houses. They would slaughter Stark and Lannister with equal fervour, as they slaughtered each other. They might spare Catelyn herself. She was still young enough to bear sons. Still, she hesitated.
I hear them, Sir Roderick called out.
Tyrion turned his head to listen. And there it was, hoofbeats, a dozen horses or more, coming nearer. Suddenly everyone was moving, reaching for weapons, running to their mounts. Pebbles rained down around them as Lares came springing and sliding down the ridge. He landed breathless in front of Catelyn Stark, an ungainly-looking man, with wild tufts of rust-coloured hair sticking out from under a conical steel cap.
20 men, maybe 25, he said, breathless. Milksnakes, or Moonbrothers bomb, I guess. They must have eyes out, milady. Hidden watchers. They know we're here.
Sir Roderick Cassell was already a horse, a long sword in hand. Mohawk crouched behind a boulder, both hands on his iron-tipped spear, a dagger between his teeth.
"You, singer," Sir Willis Woad called out, "help me with this breastplate."
Marillion sat frozen, clutching his wood harp, his face as pale as milk. But Tyrion's man, Morric, bounded quickly to his feet and moved to help the knight with his armour. Tyrion kept his grip on Catelyn Stark. "You have no choice," he told her. "Three of us, and a fourth man, wasted guarding us. Four men can be the difference between life and death up here. Give me your word that you will put down your sword again after the fight is done." "My word." The hoofbeats were louder now. Tyrion grinned crookedly. "Oh, that you have, my lady, on my honour as a Lannister." For a moment he thought she would spit at him, but instead she snapped, "Arm them." And as quick as that she was pulling away. Sir Roderick tossed Jick his sword and scabbard and wheeled to meet the foe. Morric helped himself to a bow and quiver and went to one knee beside the road. He was a better archer than the swordsman, and Bronn rode up to offer Tyrion a double-bladed axe. "I have never fought with an axe." The weapon felt awkward and unfamiliar in his hands. It had a short heft, a heavy head, a nasty spike on top.
"Pretend you're splitting lugs,"
Bronn said, drawing his long sword from the scabbard across his back. He spat and trotted off to form up beside Chigan and Sir Roderick. Sir Willis mounted up to join them, fumbling with his helmet, a metal pot with a thin slit for his eyes and a long black silk plume.
"Lugs don't bleed,"
Tyrion said to no one in particular. He felt naked without armour. He looked around for a rock and ran over to where Marillion was hiding.
"Move over!" "Go away!" the boy screamed back at him. "I'm a singer! I want no part of this fight!"
"What, lost your taste for adventure?"
Tyrion kicked at the youth until he slid over, and not a moment too soon. A heartbeat later, the riders were on them. There were no heralds, no banners, no horns, nor drums, only the twang of bowstrings as Morric and Lares let fly. And suddenly the clansmen came thundering out of the dawn, lean, dark men in boiled leather and mismatched armour, faces hidden behind barred half-helms. There were no heralds, no banners, no horns, nor drums, only the twang of bowstrings as Morric and Lares let fly. And suddenly the clansmen came thundering out of the dawn, lean, dark men in boiled leather and mismatched armour, faces hidden behind barred half-helms. In their gloved hands were clutched all manner of weapons, long-swords and lances and sharpened scythes, spiked clubs and daggers and heavy iron mauls. At their head rode a big man in a striped shadowskin cloak, armed with a two-handed greatsword. Sir Roderick shouted, "Winterfell!" and rode to meet him, with Bronn and Chigim beside him, screaming some wordless battle cry. Sir Willis Woad followed, swinging a spiked morning star around his head.
"Harrenhal! Harrenhal!" he sang.
Tyrion felt a sudden urge to leap up, brandish his axe and boom out, "Casterly Rock!" But the insanity passed quickly, and he crouched down lower. He heard the screams of frightened horses and the crash of metal on metal. Chigan's sword raked across the naked face of a mailed rider, and Bronn plunged through the clansmen like a whirlwind, cutting down foes right and left. Sir Roderick hammered at the big man in the shadowskin cloak, their horses dancing around each other as they traded blow for blow. Jick vaulted onto a horse and galloped bareback into the fray. Tyrion saw an arrow sprout from the throat of the man in the shadowskin cloak. When he opened his mouth to scream, only blood came out. By the time he fell, Sir Roderick was fighting someone else. Suddenly, Marillion shrieked, covering his head with his wood harp as a horse leapt over their rock. Tyrion scrambled to his feet as a rider turned to come back at them, hefting a spiked maul. Tyrion swung his axe with both hands. The blade caught the charging horse in the throat with a meaty thunk, angling upwards, and Tyrion almost lost his grip as the animal screamed and collapsed. He managed to wrench the axe free and lurch clumsily out of the way. Marillion was less fortunate. Horse and rider crashed to the ground in a tangle on top of the singer. Tyrion danced back in while the brigand's leg was still pinned beneath his fallen mount and buried the axe in the man's neck just above the shoulder blades. As he struggled to yank the blade loose, he heard Marillion moaning under the bodies.
"Somebody help me!" the singer gasped. "God have mercy, I'm bleeding!"
"I believe that's horse blood," Tyrion said.
The singer's hand came crawling out from beneath the dead animal, scrabbling in the dirt like a spider with five legs. Tyrion put his heel on the grasping fingers and felt a satisfying crunch. "Close your eyes and pretend you're dead," he advised the singer before he hefted the axe and turned away. After that, things ran together. The dawn was full of shouts and screams and heavy with the scent of blood, and the world had turned to chaos. Arrows hissed past his ear and clattered off the rocks. He saw Bronn unhorsed, fighting with a sword in each hand. Tyrion kept on the fringes of the fight, sliding from rock to rock and darting out of the shadows to hew at the legs of passing horses. He found a wounded clansman and left him dead, helping himself to the man's half-helm. It fit too snugly, but Tyrion was glad of any protection at all. Jick was cut down from behind while he sliced at a man in front of him, and later Tyrion stumbled over Curlicat's body. The pig face had been smashed in with a mace, but Tyrion recognized the dirk as he plucked it from the man's dead fingers. He was sliding it through his belt when he heard a woman scream. Catelyn Stark was trapped against the stone face of the mountain, with three men around her, one still mounted and the other two on foot. She had a dagger clutched awkwardly in her maimed hands, but her back was to the rock now, and they had penned her on three sides. "Let them have the bitch," Tyrion thought, "and welcome to her." Yet somehow he was moving. He caught the first man in the back of the knee before they even knew he was there, and the heavy axe head split flesh and bone like rotten wood. "Lugs that bleed," Tyrion thought inanely as a second man came for him. Tyrion ducked under his sword, lashed out with his axe. The man reeled backwards, and Catelyn Stark stepped up behind him and opened his throat. The horseman remembered an urgent engagement elsewhere and galloped off suddenly. Tyrion looked around. The enemy were all vanquished or vanished. Somehow the fighting had ended when he wasn't looking. Dying horses and wounded men lay all around, screaming or moaning. To his vast astonishment, he was not one of them. He opened his fingers and let the axe thunk to the ground. His hand was sticky with blood. He could have sworn they had been fighting for half a day, but the sun seemed scarcely to have moved at all.
"Your first battle?"
Bronn asked later, as he bent over Jick's body, pulling off his boots. They were good boots, as befit one of Lord Tywin's men. Heavy leather, oiled and supple, much finer than what Bronn was wearing. Tyrion nodded.
"My father would be so proud," he said. His legs were cramping so badly he could scarcely stand. Odd he had never once noticed the pain during the battle.
"You need a woman now,"
Bronn said, with a glint in his black eyes. He shoved the boots into his saddlebag.
"Nothing like a woman after a man's been blooded, take my word."
Chigan stopped looting the corpses of the brigands long enough to snort and lick his lips. Tyrion glanced over to where Lady Stark was dressing Sir Roderick's wounds.
"I'm willing if she is," he said.
The free riders broke into laughter, and Tyrion grinned and thought,
"There's a start."
Afterwards he knelt by the stream and washed the blood off his face in water cold as ice. As he limped back to the others, he glanced again at the slain. The dead clansmen were thin, ragged men, their horses scrawny and undersized, with every rib showing. What weapons Bronn and Chigan had left them were none too impressive. Mauls, clubs, a scythe. He remembered the big man in the shadowskin cloak who had duelled Sir Roderick with a two-handed greatsword, but when he found his corpse sprawled on the stony ground, the man was not so big after all. The cloak was gone, and Tyrion saw that the blade was badly notched, its cheap steel spotted with rust. Small wonder the clansmen had left 9 bodies on the ground. They had only 3 dead, 2 of Lord Bracken's men-at-arms, Curlicut and Mohor, and his own man Jick, who had made such a bold show with his bare-back charge. A fool to the end, Tyrion thought.
Lady Stark, I urge you to press on with all haste,
Sir Willis Woad said, his eyes scanning the ridgetops warily through the slit in his helm.
We drove them off for the moment, but they will not have gone far.
We must bury our dead, Sir Willis, she said. These were brave men. I will not leave them to the crows and shadow cats.
The soil is too stony for digging, Sir Willis said.
Then we shall gather stones for cairns.
Gather all the stones you want, Bronn told her, but do it without me or Chigan. I've better things to do than pile rocks on dead men. Breathe in for one.
He looked over the rest of the survivors.
Any of you hope to be alive come nightfall, ride with us.
My lady, I fear he speaks the truth, Sir Roderick said wearily. The old knight had been wounded in the fight, a deep gash in his left arm, and a spear thrust that grazed his neck, and he sounded his age.
If we linger here, they will be on us again for a certainty, and we may not live through a second attack.
Tyrion could see the anger in Catelyn's face, but she had no choice. May the gods forgive us, then. We will ride at once. There was no shortage of horses now. Tyrion moved his saddle to Jick-spotted gelding, who looked strong enough to last another 3 or 4 days at least. He was about to mount when Larry stepped up and said, I'll take that dirk now, dwarf.
Let him keep it.
Catelyn Stark looked down from her horse. And see that he has his axe back as well. We may have need of it if we are attacked again.
You have my thanks, lady, Tyrion said, mounting up.
Save them, she said curtly. I trust you no more than I did before. She was gone before he could frame a reply. Tyrion adjusted his stolen helm and took the axe from Bronn. He remembered how he had begun the journey, with his wrists bound and a hood pulled down over his head, and decided this was a definite improvement. Lady Stark could keep her trust. So long as he could keep the axe, he would count himself ahead in the game. Sir Willis Woad led them out. Bronn took up the rear, with Lady Stark safely in the middle, Sir Roderick a shadow beside her. Marillion kept throwing sullen looks back at Tyrion as they rode. The singer had broken several ribs, his wood harp, and all 4 fingers of his playing hand, yet the day had not been an utter loss to him. Somewhere he had acquired a magnificent shadow-skin cloak, thick black fur slashed by stripes of white. He huddled beneath its folds silently and for once had nothing to say. They heard the deep growls of shadow cats behind them before they had gone 1/2 mile, and later the wild snarling of the beasts fighting over the corpses they had left behind. Marillion grew visibly pale. Tyrion trotted up to him.
Craven, he said. Rhymes nicely with raven.
He kicked his horse and moved past the singer up to Sir Roderick and Catelyn Stark. She looked at him, lips pressed tightly together.
As I was saying before we were so rudely interrupted, Tyrion began, there is a serious flaw in Littlefinger's fable. Whatever you may believe of me, Lady Stark, I promise you this. I never bet against my family.
Arya. The one-eared Black Tom arched his back and hissed at her. Arya padded down the alley, balanced lightly on the balls of her bare feet, listening to the flutter of her heart, breathing slow, deep breaths. Quiet as a shadow, she told herself, light as a feather. The tomcat watched her come, his eyes weary. Catching cats was hard. Her hands were covered with half-healed scratches, and both knees were scabbed over where she had scraped them raw in tumbles. At first, even the cook's huge, fat kitchen cat had been able to elude her, but Sirio had kept her at it day and night. When she had run to him with her hands bleeding, he had said,
"So slow, be quicker, girl. Your enemies will give you more than scratches."
He had dabbed her wounds with Mirish fire, which burned so bad she had to bite her lip to keep from screaming. Then he sent her out after more cats. The Red Keep was full of cats. Lazy old cats dozing in the sun, cold-eyed mouses twitching their tails, quick little kittens with claws like needles, ladies' cats all combed and trusting, ragged shadows prowling the midden heaps. One by one, Arya had chased them down and snatched them up and brought them proudly to Sirio Forel. All but this one, this one-eared black devil of a tomcat.
"Oh, that's a real king of the castle right there,"
one of the gold cloaks had told her.
"Older than sin and twice as mean. One time the king was feasting the queen's father, and that black bastard hopped onto the table and snatched a roast quail right out of Lord Tywin's fingers. Robert laughed so hard he liked to burst. You stay away from that one, child."
He had run her halfway across the castle, twice around the Tower of the Hand, across the inner bailey, through the stables, down the serpentine steps, past the small kitchen and the pig yard, and the barracks of the gold cloaks, along the base of the river wall, and up more steps, and back and forth over Traitor's Walk, and then down again, and through a gate, and around a well, and in and out of strange buildings until Arya didn't know where she was. Now at last she had him. High walls pressed close on either side, and ahead was a blank, windowless mass of stone.
"Quiet as a shadow," she repeated, sliding forward, "light as a feather."
When she was three steps away from him, the tomcat bolted. Left, then right he went, and right, then left went Arya, cutting off his escape. He hissed again and tried to dart between her legs. "Quick as a snake," she thought. Her hands closed around him. She hugged him to her chest, whirring and laughing aloud as his claws raked at the front of her leather jerkin. Ever so fast, she kissed him right between the eyes and jerked her head back an instant before his claws would have found her face. The tomcat yowled and spit. "What's he doing to that cat?" Startled, Arya dropped the cat and whirled toward the voice. The tom bounded off in the blink of an eye. At the end of the alley stood a girl with a mass of golden curls, dressed as pretty as a doll, in blue satin. Beside her was a plump little blond boy with a prancing stag sewn in pearls across the front of his doublet and a miniature sword at his belt. Princess Marcella and Prince Tommen, Arya thought. A scepter as large as a draft horse hovered over them, and behind her two big men in crimson cloaks, Lannister house guards. "What were you doing to that cat, boy?" Marcella asked again. Sternly. To her brother she said, "He's a ragged boy, isn't he? Look at him." She giggled.
"A ragged, dirty, smelly boy," Tommen agreed.
"They don't know me," Arya realized. "They don't even know I'm a girl."
Small wonder. She was barefoot and dirty, her hair tangled from the long run through the castle, clad in a jerkin ripped by cat claws, and brown, rough-spun pants hacked off above her scabby knees. You don't wear skirts and silks when you're catching cats. Quickly, she lowered her head and dropped to one knee. Maybe they wouldn't recognize her. If they did, she would never hear the end of it. Septa Mordane would be mortified, and Sansa would never speak to her again from the shame. The old fat Septa moved forward.
"Boy, how did you come here? You have no business in this part of the castle."
"You can't keep his sort out," one of the red cloaks said, "like trying to keep out rats."
"Who do you belong to, boy?" the Septa demanded. "Answer me. What's wrong with you? Are you mute?"
Arya's voice caught in her throat. If she answered, Tommen and Marcella would know her for certain.
"Godwin, bring him here," the Septa said.
The taller of the guardsmen started down the alley. Panic gripped her throat like a giant's hand. Arya could not have spoken if her life had hung on it. "Calm as still water," she mouthed silently. As Godwin reached for her, Arya moved, quick as a snake. She leaned to her left, letting his fingers brush her arm, spinning around him, smooth as summer silk. By the time he got himself turned, she was sprinting down the alley, swift as a deer. The scepter was screeching at her. Arya slid between legs as thick and white as marble columns, bounded to her feet, bowled into Prince Tommen, and hopped over him when he sat down hard and said, "Oof!" Spun away from the second guard, and then she was past them all, running full out. She heard shouts, then pounding footsteps closing behind her. She dropped and rolled. The red cloak went careening past her, stumbling. Arya sprang back to her feet. She saw a window above her, high and narrow, scarcely more than an arrow slit. Arya leapt, caught the sill, pulled herself up. She held her breath as she wriggled through, slippery as an eel. Dropping to the floor in front of a startled scrub woman, she hopped up, brushed the rushes off her clothes, and was off again, out of the door and along a long hall, down a stair, across a hidden courtyard, around a corner and over a wall, and through a long, narrow window into a pitch-dark cellar. The sounds grew more and more distant behind her. Arya was out of breath and quite thoroughly lost. She was in for it now, if they had recognized her. But she didn't think they had. She moved too fast, swift as a deer. She hunkered down in the dark against a damp stone wall and listened for the pursuit. But the only sound was the beating of her own heart and a distant drip of water. "Quiet as a shadow," she told herself. She wondered where she was. When they had first come to King's Landing, she used to have bad dreams about getting lost in the castle. Father said the Red Keep was smaller than Winterfell, but in her dreams it had been immense, an endless stone maze with walls that seemed to shift and change behind her. She would find herself wandering down gloomy halls, past faded tapestries, descending endless circular stairs, darting through courtyards or over bridges, her shouts echoing unanswered. In some of the rooms, the red stone walls would seem to drip blood, and nowhere could she find a window. Sometimes she would hear her father's voice, but always from a long way off, and no matter how hard she ran after it, it would grow fainter and fainter until it faded to nothing, and Arya was alone in the dark. It was very dark right now, she realized. She hugged her bare knees tight against her chest and shivered. She would wait quietly and count to 10,000. By then it would be safe for her to come creeping back out and find her way home. By the time she had reached 87, the room had begun to lighten as her eyes adjusted to the blackness. Slowly, the shapes around her took on form. Huge, empty eyes stared at her, hungrily, through the gloom. And dimly she saw the jagged shadows of long teeth. She had lost the count. She closed her eyes and bit her lip and sent the fear away. When she looked again, the monsters would be gone. Would never have been. She pretended that Syrio was beside her in the dark, whispering in her ear, "Calm as still water," she told herself, "strong as a bear, fierce as a wolverine." She opened her eyes again. The monsters were still there, but the fear was gone. Arya got to her feet, moving warily. The heads were all around her. She touched one, curious, wondering if it was real. Her fingertips brushed a massive jaw. It felt real enough. The bone was smooth beneath her hand, cold and hard to the touch. She ran her fingers along a tooth, black and sharp, a dagger made of darkness. It made her shiver. "It's dead," she said aloud. "It's just a skull. It can't hurt me." Yet somehow, the monster seemed to know she was there. She could feel its empty eyes watching her through the gloom, and there was something in that dim, cavernous room that did not love her. She edged away from the skull and backed into a second, larger than the first. For an instant she could feel its teeth digging into her shoulder as if it wanted a bite of her flesh. Arya whirled, felt leather catch and tear as a huge fang nipped at her jerkin, and then she was running. Another skull loomed ahead, the biggest monster of all, but Arya did not even slow. She leapt over a ridge of black teeth as tall as swords, dashed through hungry jaws, and threw herself against the door. Her hands found a heavy iron ring set in the wood, and she yanked at it. The door resisted a moment before it slowly began to swing inward. With a creak so loud, Arya was certain it could be heard all through the city. She opened the door just far enough to slip through into the hallway beyond. If the room with the monsters had been dark, the hall was the blackest pit in the Seven Hells. "Calm as still water," Arya told herself. But even when she gave her eyes a moment to adjust, there was nothing to see but the vague grey outline of the door she had come through. She wiggled her fingers in front of her face, felt the air move, saw nothing. She was blind. "A water dancer sees with all her senses," she reminded herself. She closed her eyes and steadied her breathing. 1, 2, 3. Drank in the quiet, reached out with her hands. Her fingers brushed against rough, unfinished stone to her left. She followed the wall, her hands skimming along the surface, taking small gliding steps through the darkness. All halls lead somewhere. Where there is a way in, there is a way out. Fear cuts deeper than swords. Arya would not be afraid. It seemed as if she had been walking a long ways when the wall ended abruptly, and a draught of cold air blew past her cheek. Loose hairs stirred faintly against her skin. From somewhere, far below her, she heard noises. The scrape of boots, the distant sound of voices. A flickering light brushed the wall ever so faintly, and she saw that she stood at the top of a great black well, a shaft 20 feet across plunging deep into the earth. Huge stones had been set in the curving walls as steps circling down and down, dark as the steps to hell that old Nan used to tell them of. And something was coming up out of the darkness, out of the bowels of the earth. Arya peered over the edge and felt the cold black breath on her face. Far below, she saw the light of a single torch, small as the flame of a candle. 2 men she made out. Their shadows writhed against the sides of the well, tall as giants. She could hear their voices, echoing up the shaft.
"Found one bastard," one said. "The rest will come soon. A day, 2 days, a fortnight."
"And when he learns the truth, what will he do?" a second voice asked in the liquid accents of the free cities.
"The guards alone know," the first voice said.
Arya could see a wisp of grey smoke drifting up off the torch, writhing like a snake as it rose.
"The fools tried to kill his son, and what's worse, they made a mummer's farce of it. He's not a man to put that aside. I warned you, the wolf and the lion will soon be at each other's throats, whether we will it or no."
"Too soon," too soon," the voice with the accent complained. "What good is war now? We are not ready. Delay."
"As well bid me stop time. You take me for a wizard."
The other chuckled. "No less." Flames licked at the cold air. The tall shadows were almost on top of her.
An instant later, the man holding the torch climbed into her sight, his companion beside him. Arya crept back, away from the well, dropped to her stomach, and flattened herself against the wall. She held her breath as the men reached the top of the steps.
"What would you have me do?"
asked the torchbearer, a stout man in leather half-cape.
Even in heavy boots, his feet seemed to glide soundlessly over the ground. A round, scarred face and a stubble of dark beard showed under his steel cap, and he wore mail over boiled leather, and a dirk and short sword at his belt. It seemed to Arya there was something oddly familiar about him.
"If one hand can die, why not a second?" replied the man with the accent and the forked yellow beard. "You have danced the dance before, my friend."
He was no one Arya had ever seen before, she was certain of it. Grossly fat, yet he seemed to walk lightly, carrying his weight on the balls of his feet as a water dancer might. His rings glimmered in the torchlight, red, gold, and pale silver, crusted with rubies, sapphires, slitted yellow tiger eyes. Every finger wore a ring. Some had two.
"Before is not now, and this hand is not the other," the scarred man said as they stepped out into the hall.
"Still as stone," Arya told herself, "quiet as a shadow." Blinded by the blaze of their own torch, they did not see her pressed flat against the stone, only a few feet away.
"Perhaps so," the forkbeard replied, pausing to catch his breath after the long climb. "Nonetheless, we must have time. The princess is with child. The Carl will not bestir himself until his son is born. You know how they are, these savages."
The man with the torch pushed at something. Arya heard a deep rumbling. A huge slab of rock, red in the torchlight, slid down out of the ceiling with a resounding crash that almost made her cry out. Where the entry to the well had been was nothing but stone, solid and unbroken.
"If he does not bestir himself soon, it may be too late," the stout man in the steel cap said. "This is no longer a game for two players, if ever it was. Stannis Baratheon and Lysa Arryn have fled beyond my reach, and the whispers say they are gathering swords around them. The Knight of Flowers writes Highgarden, urging his lord father to send his sister to court. The girl is a maid of 14, sweet and beautiful and tractable. And Lord Renly and Sir Loras intend that Robert should bed her, wed her, make a new queen. Littlefinger, the guards only know what game Littlefinger is playing. Yet Lord Stark's the one who troubles my sleep. He has the bastard, he has the book, and soon enough he'll have the truth. And now his wife has abducted Tyrion Lannister, thanks to Littlefinger's meddling. Lord Tywin will take that for an outrage, and Jaime has a queer affection for the imp. If the Lannisters move north, that will bring the Tullys in as well. Delay, you say? Make haste, I reply. Even the finest of jugglers cannot keep 100 balls in the air forever."
"You are more than a juggler, old friend. You are a true sorcerer. All I ask is that you work your magic a while longer."
They started down the hall in the direction Arya had come, past the room with the monsters.
"What I can do, I will," the one with the torch said softly. "I must have gold and another 50 birds."
She let them get a long way ahead, then went creeping after them, quiet as a shadow.
So many!
The voices were fainter as the light dwindled ahead of her.
The ones you need are hard to find, so young, to know their letters, perhaps older, not die so easy.
No, the younger are safer. Treat them gently.
If they kept their tongues, the risk is...
Long after their voices had faded away, Ari could still see the light of the torch, a smoking star that bid her follow. Twice it seemed to disappear, but she kept on straight, and both times she found herself at the top of steep, narrow stairs, the torch glimmering far below her. She hurried after it, down and down. Once she stumbled over a rock and fell against the wall, and her hand found raw earth supported by timbers, whereas before the tunnel had been dressed stone. She must have crept after them for miles. Finally they were gone, but there was no place to go but forward. She found the wall again and followed, blind and lost, pretending that Nymeria was padding along beside her in the darkness. At the end she was knee-deep in foul-smelling water, wishing she could dance upon it as Sirio might have, and wondering if she'd ever see light again. It was full dark when finally Arya emerged into the night air. She found herself standing at the mouth of a sewer where it emptied into the river. She stank so badly that she stripped right there, dropping her soiled clothing on the river bank as she dove into the deep black waters. She swam until she felt clean and crawled out, shivering. Some riders went past along the river road as Arya was washing her clothes, but if they saw the scrawny naked girl scrubbing her rags in the moonlight, they took no notice. She was miles from the castle, but from anywhere in King's Landing, you needed only to look up to see the Red Keep high on Aegon's Hill, so there was no danger of losing her way. Her clothes were almost dry by the time she reached the gatehouse. The portcullis was down, and the gates barred, so she turned aside to a postern door. The gold cloaks, who had the watch, sneered when she told them to let her in. "Off with you," one said. "The kitchen scraps are gone. We'll have no begging after dark."
"I'm not a beggar," she said. "I live here."
"I said, off with you. Do you need a clout on the ear to help your hearing?"
"I want to see my father."
The guards exchanged a glance. "I want to fuck the queen myself, for all the good it does me," the younger said.
The older scowled. "Who's this father of yours, boy? The city rat catcher?" "The hand of the king," Arya told him. Both men laughed, but then the older one swung his fist at her, casually, as a man would swat a dog. Arya saw the blow coming even before it began. She danced back out of the way, untouched.
"I'm not a boy," she spat at them. "I'm Arya Stark of Winterfell, and if you lay a hand on me, my lord father will have both your heads on spikes. If you don't believe me, fetch Jory Cassel, or Vaen Pool, from the Tower of the Hand."
She put her hands on her hips.
"Now, are you going to open the gate, or do you need a clout on the ear to help your hearing?"
Her father was alone in the solar when Harwin and Fat Tom marched her in, an oil lamp glowing softly at his elbow. He was bent over the biggest book Arya had ever seen, a great thick tome with cracked yellow pages of crabbed script, bound between faded leather covers. But he closed it to listen to Harwin's report. His face was stern as he sent the men away with thanks.
"You realize I had half my guard out searching for you?" Eddard Stark said when they were alone. "Septa Mordane is beside herself with fear. She's in the Sept praying for your safe return. Arya, you know you are never to go beyond the castle gates without my leave." "I didn't go out of the gates," she blurted. "Well, I didn't mean to. I was down in the dungeons, only they turned into this tunnel. It was all dark, and I didn't have a torch or a candle to see by, so I had to follow. I couldn't go back the way I came on account of the monsters. Father, they were talking about killing you. Not the monsters, the two men. They didn't see me. I was being still as stone and quiet as a shadow, but I heard them. They said you had a book and a bastard, and if one hand could die, why not a second? Is that the book? John's a bastard, I bet. John? Arya, what are you talking about? Who said this? They did, she told him. There was a fat one with rings and a forked yellow beard, and another in mail and a steel cap, and the fat one said they had to delay, but the other one told him he couldn't keep juggling, and the wolf and the lion were going to eat each other, and it was a mummer's farce. She tried to remember the rest. She hadn't quite understood everything she heard, and now it was all mixed up in her head. The fat one said the princess was with child. The one in the steel cap, he had the torch. He said they had to hurry. I think he was a wizard. A wizard, Ned said, unsmiling. Did he have a long white beard and a tall pointed hat speckled with stars? No, it wasn't like old Nan's stories. He didn't look like a wizard, but the fat one said he was. I warn you, Arya, if you're spinning this thread of air... No, I told you. It was in the dungeons by the place with the secret wall. I was chasing cats and, well... She screwed up her face. If she admitted knocking over Prince Tommen, he would be really angry with her. Well, I went in this window. That's where I found the monsters. Monsters and wizards, her father said. It would seem you had quite an adventure. These men you heard. You say they spoke of juggling and mummery? Yes, Arya admitted. Only, Arya, they were mummers, her father told her. There must be a dozen troops in King's Landing right now, come to make some coin off the tawny crowds. I'm not certain what these two men were doing in the castle, but perhaps the king had asked for a show. No, she shook her head stubbornly. They weren't. You shouldn't be following people about and spying on them in any case. Nor do I cherish the notion of my daughter climbing in strange windows after stray cats. Look at you, sweetling. Your arms are covered with scratches. This has gone on long enough. Tell Cyrio Farrell that I want a word with him. He was interrupted by a short, sudden knock. Lord Eddard pardons, Desmond called out, opening the door a crack. But there's a black brother here begging audience. He says the matter is urgent. I thought you would want to know. My door is always open to the night's watch, Father said. Desmond ushered the man inside. He was stooped and ugly, with an unkempt beard and unwashed clothes, yet Father greeted him pleasantly and asked his name.
Euron, as it please, my lord. My pardons for the hour,
he bowed to Arya.
And this must be your son. He has your look.
I'm a girl, Arya said, exasperated. If the old man was down from the wall, he must have come by way of Winterfell. Do you know my brothers? She asked excitedly. Rob and Bran are at Winterfell, and John's on the wall. Jon Snow, he's in the Night's Watch too. You must know him. He has a direwolf, a white one with red eyes. Is John a ranger yet? I'm Arya Stark. The old man in the smelly black clothes was looking at her oddly, but Arya could not seem to stop talking. When you ride back to the wall, would you bring John a letter if I wrote one? She wished John was here now. He'd believe her about the dungeons and the fat man with a forked beard and the wizard in the steel cap. My daughter often forgets her courtesies, Eddard Stark said with a faint smile that softened his words. I beg your forgiveness, Yoren. Did my brother Benjen send you?
No one sent me, my lord, save O'Mormont. I'm here to find men for the war, and when Robert next holds court, I'll bend the knee and cry our need. See if the king and his hand have some scum in the dungeons they'd be well rid of. You might say, as Benjen Stark is why we're talking, though. His blood ran black. Made him my brother, as much as yours. It's for his sake I'm come. Rode hard I did, nearly killed my horse the way I drove her. but I left the others well behind.
The others? Yorin spat.
Sell swords and free riders and light trash. That inn was full of them, and I saw them take the scent of blood or the scent of gold. They smell the same in the end. Not all of them made for King's Landing, either. Some went galloping off for Casterly Rock, and the rock lies closer. Lord Tywin will have gotten the word by now, you can count on it.
Father Frond, what word is this? Yoren eyed Arya.
One best spoken in private, my lord, begging your pardons.
As you say, Desmond, see my daughter to her chambers. He kissed her on the brow. We'll finish our talk on the morrow. Arya stood rooted to the spot. Nothing bad's happened to John, has it? She asked Yoren. Or Uncle Benjen?
Well, as to start, I can't say. The Snow Boy was well enough when I left the war. It's not them that concerns me.
Desmond took her hand. Come along, my lady. You heard your lord father. Arya had no choice but to go with him, wishing it had been Fat Tom. With Tom, she might have been able to linger at the door on some excuse and hear what Yoren was saying, but Desmond was too single-minded to trick. How many guards does my father have? She asked him, as they descended to her bedchamber. Here at King's Landing? 50. You wouldn't let anyone kill him, would you? She asked. Desmond laughed. No fear on that count, little lady. Lord Eddard's guarded night and day. He'll come to no harm. The Lannisters have more than 50 men, Arya pointed out. So they do, but every northerner is worth 10 of these southern swords, so you can sleep easy. What if a wizard was sent to kill him? Well, as to that, Desmond replied, drawing his longsword, wizards die the same as other men, once you cut their heads off.
Circe. A thousand ships! The little queen's brown hair was tousled and uncombed, and the torchlight made her cheeks look flushed, as if she had just come from some man's embrace. Your grace, this must be answered fiercely! Her last word rang off the rafters and echoed through the cavernous throne room. Seated on her gold and crimson high seat beneath the iron throne, Circe could feel a growing tightness in her neck. Must, she thought. She dare say must to me. She itched to slap the Tyrell girl across the face. She should be on her knees begging for my help. Instead, she presumes to tell her rightful queen what she must do. 1,000 ships, Sir Harry's Swift was wheezing. Surely not. No lord commands 1,000 ships. Some frightened fool has counted double, agreed Orton Merriweather. That or Lord Tyrell's bannermen are lying to us, puffing up the numbers of the foe so we will not think them lax. The torches on the back wall threw the long barbed shadow of the iron throne halfway to the doors. The far end of the hall was lost in darkness, and Circe could not but feel that the shadows were closing around her too. My enemies are everywhere, and my friends are useless. She had only to glance at her counsellors to know that. Only Lord Qyburn and Aurain Waters seemed awake. The others had been roused from bed by Margaery's messengers pounding on their doors, and stood there, rumpled and confused. Outside, the night was black and still. The castle and the city slept. Boros Blount and Merin Trant seemed to be sleeping too, albeit on their feet. Even Osmond Kettleblack was yawning. Not Loras, though, not our Knight of Flowers. He stood behind his little sister, a pale shadow with a longsword on his hip. Half as many ships would still be 500, my lord, Waters pointed out to Orton Merriweather. Only the Arbor has enough strength at sea to oppose a fleet that size. What of your new dromans? Asked Sir Harry's. The longships of the Iron Men cannot stand before our dromans, surely. King Robert's hammer is the mightiest warship in all Westeros. "She was," said Waters. "Sweet Circe will be her equal once complete, and Lord Tywin will be twice the size of either. Only half are fitted out, however, and none is fully crewed.